You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
The book of Micah is one of what's called the minor prophets, and not because it's less important, but simply because it's one of a dozen shorter books from prophets who were not Isaiah or Jeremiah. Much of what we know today as Micah was probably written around 800 years before Jesus' life, when Judean politics, society, and worship had slid into an unjust arrangement that favored the rich. They lorded their privilege over the poor in ostentatious worship and behavior. So Micah is basically saying to the privileged, cut it out, or else. Overall, his whole prophecy rocks back and forth between judgment and hope, judgment and hope, and the passage that we hear today has a little bit of both. So, with apologies to those who've heard this passage so many times before, it is one of my favorite Bible verses. It also happens to be kind of a summary of the whole of Judeo-Christianity. So, let's listen again to Micah chapter 6, verse 6 through 8.
Our words of wisdom are from Micah chapter 6, verses 6 through 8.
With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old?
Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, fruit of my body for the sin of my soul?
He has told you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Back in January of 2017, the congregation of the Victoria Islamic Center in Texas was devastated. In what was later determined to be an anti-Muslim hate crime, its mosque had been burned to the ground. But then Dr. Gary Branfman, a member of Temple B'nai Israel in Victoria, showed up at the home of the Islamic Center's president, Dr. Shahid Hashmi, with what? Keys to the synagogue. What? Jews opening their synagogue to Muslims? Well, if Rabbi Shaiheld had his way, this kind of thing wouldn't be a surprise to anyone. Why? Because, in the words of a Talmudic sage he quotes in Judaism is about love, Judaism is about love, and its goal is to make us kinder and more present for one another. Rabbi Simlai declares, the beginning of Torah is acts of loving kindness, and the end of Torah is acts of loving kindness. And taken together with doing justice, this is what the Jewish tradition and our passage today refers to as walking in God's ways. Throughout the Torah, the fundamental vision of a good life is to live out loving kindness, of doing the good things that God does in every aspect of one's life. The Midrash explains, as God is merciful, so you must be merciful. As God is gracious, righteous, kind, you must be righteous, gracious, and kind. But it's not just embodying these character traits that we associate with God. To really walk in God's ways is about practical actions. Talmudic scholars point to stories in the Bible about God's actions and say, as God clothes the naked, so you must clothe the naked. As God visits the sick, so you must visit the sick. As God comforts the mourner, so you must comfort the mourner. As God buries the dead, so you must bury the dead. The traditional Jewish word for all this, chesed, is notoriously difficult to translate, having been rendered most often as loving kindness. But Rabbi Held suggests breaking the word into loving and kindness, implying love manifested in acts of kindness. But wait, say some of you more snarky listeners. We're supposed to emulate some divine attributes like mercy and righteousness, but leave off anger and jealousy, clothing the naked and visiting the sick are on the list to follow, but flooding the world and smiting our enemies or not? Well, rest assured, there is no source anywhere that recommends, just as God sometimes gets angry and launches a plague, so too must you launch a plague, no matter how gratifying that might sometimes seem. Jewish texts acknowledge that God can sometimes be a bit of a bad actor and actually prohibits human beings from doing the whole divine wrath and bad behavior thing as being unbecoming to humanity. So let's acknowledge that, yes, life is full of pain. Pain we want relief from. Pain we want to run away from. But Judaism's message is clear. Resist the urge to flee. Instead, Jews are encouraged to run toward the very people and places most people want to run away from. Rabbi Held says, if you want to be a religious person, learn to be present for other people when they are in pain. But there are some ground rules for being present. First, leave your pity at home. Pity is where you hold yourself apart from the afflicted person and their suffering. Pity reaches down to someone. Forget that. What we're called to is compassion. And compassion reaches across to people, aware that what connects us runs far deeper than what divides us. With pity, we feel sorry for someone. With compassion, we feel sorry with them. Likewise, this walking in God's ways means being fully present for others when they suffer. And that's not easy, because as a rule, most of us are not inclined to be with other people in unresolvable pain. We want to fix things. We bring our own agendas to situations, when what is really needed is just our presence. Rabbi Held will often take his students to visit in a memory care facility where many of his students are very uncomfortable. He writes that one student said, I don't understand why we come here. I mean, it's not like we can actually do anything for the residents. Clearly, the student couldn't tolerate the feeling of powerlessness in the face of reality, when what all they really needed to do was be present. Walking humbly in God's ways is not always about being productive as the world counts productivity. When I was training as a chaplain, it took me a while to appreciate it, but one of the most effective tools we used in evaluating our efficacy as a caregiver was the verbatim. After meeting with a patient, we would quickly write down word for word, as best we could remember, the whole conversation. Then our entire group would sit down together and analyze the conversation. Being ruthlessly honest, the group would identify where we brought our own agenda in, where we tried to force things or fix things, and where we hadn't genuinely heard the patient's concerns. It could be brutal sometimes, but so helpful in seeing how often we fail to be genuinely present to other people's real concerns. Being with real people makes it harder to be insulated and isolated from the hurts around us that can otherwise be invisible. Bottom line, most of us need to intentionally seek out contact with people who have not had the advantages we've had in order for us to truly grow into the kind of person God calls us to be. What we're talking about is not just some pie-in-the-sky appeal to just be a good person. It's not about simply saying please or thank you or being reasonably polite. If Jews are going to be serious about what Judaism calls walking in God's way, and we Christians are serious about what Jesus says when he says, follow me, then we are pledging to work toward a world that reflects divine priorities. And what are those? The poor, the voiceless, the excluded. And this necessarily involves not just our person-to-person involvement, but also our social and political involvement. And this is where things always become more complicated and more emotional for some people. The people who have never read the Bible usually pipe up here and say, hey, religion and politics don't mix. Sorry to break it to you, but being a person of faith is about so much more than a superficial performance of niceness. Rabbi Held writes, if we care about the world, we should be willing to fight for it, to care about other people so deeply that we work to prevent their being mistreated and exploited. He complains that it's as if so many of us gush with saccharine claims to God of, oh, I love you, and then, thinking we've fulfilled our religious duty, aren't listening enough to hear God respond, okay, prove it. There are people suffering out there. Go and do something about it. And don't just use a Band-Aid. Figure out why people are suffering. Rabbi Held recalls that when Catholic Bishop Dom Helder Camara of Brazil began to speak out for social reforms in his country, he famously said, when I gave food to the poor, they called me a saint. When I began to ask why there were so many poor, they called me a communist. We have to commit to not being intimidated by those who are unfamiliar with the fact that changing the world for the better is at the very heart of both Judaism and Christianity. And yes, this means changing the values of our culture. Rabbi Held says to Jews, we need to reevaluate what we mean when we say that we want our children to be successful. It's fine if you want your child to be successful in the conventional terms of being a doctor or a lawyer. But be prouder of the fact that your child makes the time to visit a homebound old woman, to serve dinner to the poor, or to help a struggling child learn to read. In reality, human dignity is trampled on in countless ways every day. How can we go on talking about a God who loves when brutality and misery is overrunning the world? It's simple, but not easy. Rabbi Held says, it's up to us, Jews and Christians, to stand in the gap between what we aspire to and what we experience every day. In a world drowning in hatred and hostility, we are summoned to stand for love. If we read the Bible and listen carefully, we will be moved beyond ourselves and our own concerns, and we will be uncomfortable at times. Taken seriously, the prophetic words of the Bible will cause us to squirm and re-examine our priorities. As both Jews and followers of Jesus, we understand that what is expected of us is both personal and social change. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to practice kindness, and to walk humbly with your God? Not vengeance, not revenge, and not superiority, but justice, kindness, and humility. Rabbi Held asks, when we die, each of us is asked, did you create moments of redemption, even in the midst of this impossibly broken, thoroughly unredeemed world? Did you create pockets of holiness, even in the midst of this so often totally profane and degraded world? Did you create a home or a school or a classroom or a work environment or a city block in which human dignity was real and the presence of God was manifest? With the way you carried yourself, did you strive to build those things? Did you create glimmers of the promised land, even as you had no choice but to live in the wilderness? Without justice, human beings can't live together as God intended. Without kindness and mercy, life is unbearable. And unless one walks humbly in the presence of the mystery we call God, we are likely to be humbled in ways we least expect. Yeah, looking around at the reality of the world right now, you may be tempted to just throw up your arms in despair. But too bad for you. As Rabbi Held keeps saying to his Jewish readers, and as we know as Jesus followers, we are not allowed to bury our heads in the sand. We need to look beyond all the hateful, racist, fearful, exclusive, punitive, disappointing, and cruel policies and actions we see, and know deep down that they will not have the final word. Look, things are not always going to go the way we planned. And to make that point, Rabbi Held points out a peculiar element of the Torah that has a parallel in the Gospel of Mark. The Pentateuch, five books, used to be the Hexateuch, six books. It used to end with the triumphant book of Joshua and the arrival in the promised land. But somewhere along the line, the editors lopped Joshua off. And now the last book, Deuteronomy, ends with the wandering tribes just short of entering the promised land. They can see it. They've got a glimpse of it. But they haven't made it there yet. It's a classic literary cliffhanger. Will they get there? Will the reality of the promised land ever be realized? Likewise, if you read Mark 16 closely, you'll see that after verse 8, where it says, the women left the empty tomb terrified and said nothing to anyone, there are still a few paragraphs detailing appearances by the risen Jesus. But there's an asterisk. It notes that the oldest, most reliable manuscripts end at verse 8, with no appearances by Jesus at all, leaving the original readers with the women running away in fear and the lunkhead disciples in hiding. So before someone came in and messed it up by adding more verses, Mark also ends with a cliffhanger. Is there anybody left to actually do what Jesus taught us to do? If you're a disciple worth your salt, you'd be jumping up to get to work. If it's going to happen, it's up to us. As both Jews and followers of Jesus, we are called to walk in God's way. And that means, despite the disappointments, the challenges, and despite what appears to be defeat, we are called to be healers, liberators, troublemakers, and in all things, practitioners of love. And as the world is so profoundly screwed up, There's absolutely no chance of us ever being without a purpose in our lives. The only thing we need to fear is forgetting that siren call from the great Elie Wiesel. The opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. One of my favorite stories from my mentor Harold Beck is about Giacomo Puccini, legendary composer of the operas Tosca, La Bohème, and Madame Butterfly. Harold recalls that in 1922, Puccini was diagnosed with terminal cancer. Nevertheless, he told his students, "I think I'm going to write one more opera." His students said, "Maestro, stop, you've got cancer." And he said, "No, I'm going to do this." And despite his friend's advice to stop and rest and save his energy, he worked on the score day and night. And when his sickness worsened, Puccini gathered up his disciples and told them, "If I don't finish, I want you to continue." And sure enough, soon after, he died, leaving the work unfinished. His disciples gathered all that he had written, studied it in great detail, and proceeded to write the remainder of the opera. Then in 1926, in La Scala Opera House in Milan, an eager audience awaited the world premiere of Turandot. Conducted by Puccini's favorite student, Arturo Toscanini, the opera went beautifully until the middle of Act Three. That was the last part written personally by Puccini. Toscanini stopped the music, put down the baton, turned to the audience, and with tears in his eyes announced, "Thus far the master wrote, but he died." There was a long pause. No one moved. Then Toscanini picked up the baton, turned to the audience, and announced, "But his disciples finished his work." The opera closed to thunderous applause and to a permanent place in the annals of great works. Toscanini finished his master's work. Will we? Be well.
Hey, and don't forget, if you like what you heard today, buy me a copy. Thanks, Brianna.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.